It's time for Magnuson Nature News, a monthly program about the amazing nature inside Magnuson Park. Each episode has a different theme, featuring animals or plants that live here in the park. You'll hear fascinating facts and true nature stories, interviews with kids or adults who know a lot about nature, the best places inside Magnuson Park to find animals and plants, and much, much more. Magnuson Nature News is brought to you by Magnuson Children's Garden, a great place for the whole family to visit any month of the year, and where all of our events are free. I'm your host, Emily Bishton, and I'd like to give a special welcome to all kids and adults who know me from my years of teaching at Magnuson Children's Garden, Magnuson Nature Programs, and the Jane Addams Sandpoint and Dunlap School Gardens. Magnuson Children's Garden is delighted to be a part of Space 101.1 FM and hope you enjoy this edition of Magnuson Nature News. On last month's show, I told about where birds and mammals and reptiles and some of the other creatures of Magnuson Park go during the cold and rainy winter months, since they don't have a house or apartment like we humans do. Let's not forget about the creatures that live in the wetlands. What about the frogs? Well, the frogs in the wetlands sometimes stay around in the land, on the trees, and crawling around at the edges of the ponds all winter long. But when it's really cold, they can also produce that chemical substance inside their body to keep their body from freezing. And they can shut down their metabolism and wait until it gets warm. After all, they mostly eat insects, and warmer weather is when insects come out. They can slow down all their normal functions. And they call that by its own name, too. It's called brumation, because it's different than hibernation also. You know, frogs like to live in a cool and damp place all year round. In fact, in the summer, they're looking to get out of the heat. But it does sometimes get too cold, even for frogs. They go to brumate in a moist shelter, once again, piles of branches or leaves, cracks in the ground, burrows from mice or voles or rats. They might crawl right down into a burrow, and they might even go inside a building. Now, if you were listening to my radio show way back in last February, you would have heard the story about the Pacific tree frogs that spent the winter inside the children's garden worm bin. But if you haven't heard it, I'm going to tell it again. When we put all the good new straw and fallen leaves in the worm bin at the end of summer, there were no frogs in there, just worms and roly-polies, some beetle larvae, few centipedes. But in the middle of winter, when we went back to feed the worms with some lunch leftovers, there were 7 tree frogs in the bin. That place was jumping with a frog party. And do you know what they were eating? All the creatures in there, including the worms. In fact, those tree frogs got big, for a tree frog anyway, and fat. And they couldn't squeeze back out through the cracks that they squeezed into in the fall. And they were kind of stuck in there. So we had to open the lid of the bin and prop it open so it wouldn't slam shut. And take off the little tarp that we put over the worm bin bedding and wait until they hopped out, because it was time to go to the wetlands, find a mate, start peeping and singing like they do all spring long. And we wanted to help them so they wouldn't be stuck inside the worm bin. But they liked it there. And I think it was kind of like a giant hollow log full of food. And they were kind of feeling pretty good about what they found, the way to spend the winter. I wonder if they told all the other frogs at the wetlands about it, because every year we have frogs in the worm bin in the winter now. But we've never had 7, except for that first time. Pretty cool. Let's think of some other wetland creatures. Well, there's turtles. They like to burrow under logs and piles of leaves. And they can actually stay swimming around under the water, even in places where there's ice that forms on the ponds. Pretty darn amazing. Another creature that lives in the wetlands and even sometimes in the children's garden are garter snakes, which are just so cool. They mostly eat bugs. They can store their food. When they eat a lot of food in the fall to get ready for winter, they can store their food as fat inside their body, and they can live off of that for long periods of time without eating. They have a place that they brumate called a hibernaculum. Try to say that 3 times in a row. Hibernaculum, hibernaculum, hibernaculum. They might make their hibernaculum also inside the burrow of a rodent. Or maybe there's a hollow space underneath a tree stump where the ground has washed away. Or inside a rock pile or in a crevice in a big rock. It's just got to stay warm and dry enough for them not to freeze. And it has to have some air movement so it doesn't get too hot. Because sometimes there's a lot of snakes all together. Kind of like the worms get together in a big ball. The snakes will get together and just be close to each other so they can keep each other warm. In fact, they will use the same hibernaculum year after year if it's still available. And I think there might be one somewhere in the rocks in the children's garden, as I see them come out from underneath the rocks sometimes in March or April. But you know, garter snakes are so cool. They don't bite and they're not poisonous, so you don't have to be scared of them. They're fun to watch. Other creatures that live in the wetlands actually live in the ponds. Have you ever wondered what all those aquatic insects do in the winter? Lots of them overwinter as nymphs or larvae. Dragonflies, mayflies, and stoneflies can live in the water of the ponds, even beneath the ice, and keep feeding and growing all winter until it's time for them to emerge from the ponds as adults in the springtime. But one of the biggest creatures that lives in the wetlands all year round, including the winter, are the beavers. And beavers have some incredible physical adaptations to be able to live there in the winter. First of all, their tail stores a lot of fat. So in the fall, they eat a whole lot of extra food to store fat in their tail, and their tail gets thicker, even can get 3 times as thick to store all that fat. And underneath their fur, they have a fat layer in their skin that really helps insulate their bodies so they can be swimming around in freezing cold water. And their fur is super thick. It has 2 layers. It has a soft inner layer of real felty fur, and then a top layer of longer hairs that all the hairs in their fur stick together and hold their shape and also shed the water so they can warm up when they get back in their lodge. And they harvest extra food in the fall, cutting extra tree branches and taking them down under the ponds, pushing them down in the mud at the bottom of the ponds in huge piles near their lodge, sort of like they're having a kitchen cupboard. And then when they get hungry, if they don't feel like going out into the cold air or even in the snow to cut down another tree, they just go get a piece of branch from one of the piles near their lodge, chew off about a foot long piece of it, and eat it just like corn on the cob. Pretty cool. Did you know that there are also some ducks and other waterfowl that fly all the way from the Pacific Ocean or Puget Sound to come to Magnuson Park to spend the winter on the freshwater ponds in the wetlands? There are greater and lesser scaups, golden eyes, buffleheads, and even mergansers that come, swim around in the freshwater ponds, dive to the bottom to eat snails and other aquatic creatures, and then find sheltered little areas along the edge of the water in the wood chips or up under the bushes along the edge of the water, and they're able to stay out of the rain and out of the wind. And compared to living out on the wild Pacific Ocean or Puget Sound where the waves are high and cold, the wetlands seems like a really nice little warm oasis. Pretty amazing. Now it's time for my special guest interview. This month we have a really special guest who I've been wanting to interview for quite a while. Her name is Cindy Hazard, and she is one of the main people who started Magnuson Children's Garden many years ago.
Welcome to the radio show, Cindy. It is so nice to have you as our special guest this month.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
And one of the things that I'd like to talk about today is kind of the very beginning of the children's garden, way back when it was just an idea and a dream. How did you personally kind of get involved and, you know, what made you want to jump in and lead the garden process?
Right. Well, I was a master gardener. This is probably 1998, something like that. And I was looking for a new service project. I'd been doing my service hours at the University Farmers Market for about a year, and I was just looking for a new project to dive into. I'd newly moved into a new home over near Magnuson, so it just made perfect sense for me to get involved in a project at Magnuson. And the timing just really worked out well. The community garden, the Magnuson Community Garden, was forming their board, and they were formalizing this new community garden, and they needed people to sit on that board. So I agreed and kind of unraveled from there.
Wow. Well, how did the children's garden design get started?
Okay. Well, it was a really interesting process. The community garden had a placeholder for several elements within the garden. And so we had the help of Barker Architects and some folks from Children's Hospital, and we held a design charrette down there at the Brig, and it was a really creative process. It involved the community members, some families, a lot of parents brought their young kids, and we led these participants through this creative process of dreaming a garden, and just gathered all of their really creative impromptu ideas for this tulip garden. And it ended up providing us some really great creative ideas, inspiration from these young minds about what a children's garden would mean to them.
That is so cool. And mm-hmm. I remember, I think, reading an article that you wrote for the Master Gardener newsletter at that time, mm-hmm. describing the mm-hmm. way that you had done coordinated the design charrette and how mm-hmm. that, you know, kids' ideas were just, you know, kind of pouring out of them with all kinds of wonderful ideas. And mm-hmm. and then the design team worked on putting all those things together. And it was really inspiring to me. Why I got involved, because I just thought the way you were doing this and encouraging kids to be creative was just the kind of perfect way to create a children's mm-hmm. garden.
Yeah, for sure.
So what were some of the main things that came out of those first design charrettes as far mm-hmm. as the kind of features that people might see if they go to the garden today?
Yeah. Well, there were a few themes that definitely came up. The concept of paths and spiral, like circular forms, there were ideas of maze-like features where they really wanted to be able to hide or, you know, wind their way through a path somewhere. One of the kids wanted to go, you know, up to a lookout, and it just happened that the garden had this big mound of dirt, that some soil that had been moved from, you know, excavated from another part of the garden. And so we had this mound, and anyway, so that was great. And they wanted to, what else did they want? They wanted to have insects and birds and wildlife attracted. And so, of course, lots of flowers. Flowers came up a lot. Butterflies, attracting butterflies. And they also, one thing that when you go to the children's garden today, you'll see is there's a stretch of lawn that starts at the top of this hill, this mound, and it's just a quadrant of the hill, and it's all lawn, and they wanted to be able to roll down the lawn. And I mean, what a perfect thing to provide them. How often, you know, do you get to just design a rolling lawn into a garden? There were really fun ideas. Water was a big, a lot of them wanted water. I mean, some of the ideas were, of course, whoa, okay, let's reel you back in. We may not be able to do that. But it was fun to hear that they liked the idea of waters and water elements and tunnels and things like that. And we've managed to achieve some of those in a natural way.
Absolutely. And there have been plenty of grown-ups roll down the rolling hill over the last 20 years.
No kidding.
Yeah. I think. Hey. So, yeah. And soon afterward, I can remember the little shed was built, because that was something mm-hmm. the kids kind of wanted there to be sort of a little house there. And mm-hmm. The shed was needed for the tools. And I feel lucky I got to be involved in the as to help out with the charrette that was done in 2004 or 5, I think, that resulted
right.
in the kids looking down from the lookout, because it was all planted by then, and looking at some of the areas at the base of the hill and thinking up the gray whale garden and mm-hmm. The starfish garden. And
That was fun. That was a great period when we were able to add those more whimsical elements of art and sculpture, and thanks to, you know, Starbucks for a wonderfully generous grant, and we were able to do those things.
Another question I have for you is, when the garden was being built, I know that Children's Hospital helped a lot with the earth moving and kind of the big things that happened, but kids and parents did the planting and the care of the garden. And I'm just curious about how you got started organizing those community stewardship events.
Yeah. Well, I had a lot of young parents with young kids, because that's what I was. I mean, I had a 4-year-old And not long after that, Jasper, my second child, was born. So I had young children, and so that was my community. So if you look at some of those early work parties, there are lots of little kids, and it was really fun. But I just used, you know, word of mouth, people I knew. We tried to put flyers up at local, you know, shops, like City People's and PCC and community centers and things. But a lot of it just kind of grew out of just the community of preschool-age kids and school-age kids that I knew, and friends of their friends. And that's kind of how we had those first few work parties. I have a really strong memory of planting those five trees at the top of the hill when I was really, that's all there was this dirt hill and a few graded paths. That was really remarkable that we actually were able to plant those trees.
Yeah. They really make the lookout special, having kind of those pillars at the top of the hill.
Yeah, those are great. That's a beautiful tree, and they've really grown well and just really make quite a statement up there at the top.
Yeah. I'm curious about do you have a favorite part of the garden now that it's been growing for so many years?
You know, well, I do love that whale bed. I mean, that was so fun to create and to work with the artist that created the mosaic tail and the eyes. And it took several years for it to really grow in and start to actually take form and look like what it was supposed to. But now with that, the grass spout, when it blooms, it really looks like a whale spout. And I love it when kids sit up on the whale tail and just soak in the sun. And so that's probably really my favorite part. But I do also just love the diversity of all the plants that we've put into that garden over the years. Some have come and gone, but the initial planting palette was so diverse for a reason, right? We really wanted to create a sensory experience for kids. So there's some plants with thorns, and there's plants that smell funny or smell good, and there's, you know, berries to eat and a little bit of everything, which is kind of fun to be able to design all that into one garden. So
absolutely. Having come in after the initial design was done, I was and still am very impressed with the plants that were chosen and how well they're doing on that site.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of kids have climbed that whale tail. I cannot even count. I'm sure at least 10,000 kids have been on that whale tail in the last 10 or 20 years. It's a little magnet, and it's really, really fun. And, you know, you are the longest member of the Children's Garden Committee, having been there at the very beginning and even mm-hmm. before the beginning, and, you know, still participating in, you know, providing advice and helping mm-hmm. to some of our stewardship events. And so I'd love to hear, you know, what has kept you involved all these years? Now your kids are pretty grown up, and
it's so rewarding to work in a garden that has such a clear mission. And, you know, the garden has just had so many great supporters over the years and just really wonderful people and getting involved. And so it's just been a pleasure to be able to help fulfill that mission and see it really develop and even, you know, become greater, I think, than any of us might have thought it would or originally. So that's really rewarding. And it's so great to be able to, if you're volunteering, to work somewhere close to where you live. And so that's kind of like a real basic thing that's kept me there in the pea patch that I was involved in for many years. But I think really just the clear mission of engaging children in nature and learning about the environment and preserving the beauty and that whole part of the education that happens there, that's really has kept me involved, because it just really is a really true mission that rings very clear.
I agree. It's you know, it's the reason for me that even though I'm retired from my Parks Department job, I want to stay involved too,
mm-hmm.
because
it's kind of a magical place. And
yeah,
when I, you know, get to see kids, if I'm just there kind of puttering around in the garden and I see kids wandering with their parents, and even if they've never been to the garden before, they will go up the spiral path to the lookout, and they will go down to the willow house and climb on the whale
yeah.
tail. It's like it needs no explanation. The garden,
right.
it communicates clearly with kids about interacting with it. And I think that's, you know, that was born from those, you know, design charrettes and that, you know, things that we kept doing over the years to invite more input has made it so that because the ideas came from the hearts and minds of kids,
mm-hmm.
it's like, you know, another kid can read that just from the garden itself. So
true.
I give you a lot of kudos for getting it started off in such a great way creatively.
Thank you.
That spirit has, I feel honored to have continued it over the years that I've been involved and being a part of having kids input and to create the new features. And
it's a special place.
Yeah. Well, any other memories you want to share of the garden or anything?
I don't think so. I just, so many different work parties, so many, you know, great, I have some great memories of the classes you've led, actually, you know, the nature camps when I helped out with those.
That's right.
Once the garden was built. Yeah. Just, you know.
I forgot that. The very first year of the programs, you and I were the teachers for the summer camp.
Yeah,
that's a very
you have a great way with kids, and just the, you know, the scratch and sniff plants and all the and the fun, just way that we, you know, led kids through the garden in a real sensory way. That was pretty special.
Yeah, it was. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. I really appreciate it. It's really fun to get to kind of stroll down memory lane with you and hear about the very beginnings of the garden and all the time since. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
That was pretty cool. Just think, if you were one of the kids at those very early design charrettes and dreamt up ideas like the lookout and the rolling lawn, you would be already done with high school now and maybe even a grown-up with your own apartment. And all the great ideas you had back then would have been enjoyed by thousands and thousands of other kids for all these years. That also means if you helped dream up ideas during the past 4 years of design charrettes in the garden, your ideas have already been appearing, such as lots of new benches and tables to sit at or picnic on or read a book, the new butterfly-shaped pollinator garden and the willow house. And all your great ideas have already been enjoyed by a lot of kids and will be enjoyed by many, many more. One thing that's so great about sharing our ideas and dreams and making them come true is that they're super fun for whoever thought of them, and they're super fun for all the other kids and families who visit the garden for years and years afterward. We sure hope you'll visit the garden. Hope to see you in the park.